Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 24 for July 28, 2014. I just wanted to give a proud update that I have put up the podcast information that I have promised all these years. It's a pretty substantial document. It's like 3,000 words, hand-coded, and it's got pretty much every link that mattered that I've referred to over the months. And it's got a nice, basically like a nice substantial paragraph on each Floydcast. It's funny, the only Floydcast where there wasn't a substantial paragraph was the one on making bread. Because that was the whole Floydcast, was making bread. The wireless update one that I did some episodes back, it had the 30 stories in 5 different categories. All those links are up there. That was kind of fun to work on. I finished that yesterday morning. Yay! As always, I'm trying to choose the sort of the core theme. Something we can relate to that would be interesting that... How to describe it? Something that'll sort of capture your mind and your thinking and you can riff off of. You know, it has enough going on that in talking about it, you'll talk about 10 things. That's one of the things about news stories is usually they don't produce a lot of other thought. I wonder if that's on purpose. And they sort of give you a crumb, and the crumb keeps you going at your cubicle, right? You buy the paper, you take it to work, and it has little crumbs of stories that are 3 months out of the date, you know. They always hide the actual information in paragraph 6. You know, there's something about newspapers and the standard way the news is delivered that's pretty unnatural. Anyway, my central theme for each podcast that I try for is more like, you know, a hefty Wired article. Like, let's say a 5-page Wired article. Something more hefty and substantial where you get to know the guy who's invented some crazy thing or the story of some startup company. Or, you know, they do really a very diverse range of stories on Wired. Wasn't planning to talk about them. There was a time when I read Wired very, you know, sort of faithfully, and there was always a lot of good stories in there. And then there still can be the odd story. A little bit, just seems a little bit less compelling. There was a time, and I don't know if it's still true, but they had all their archives online. You could read all the back stories, which was really pretty awesome. I've referred to those stories many times. Well, yesterday turned out to be easy to figure out what to talk about today, because yesterday I had this project in mind. I wanted to set up a system to collect some of the rainwater from our roof. I'm on the wet coast, and so, first of all, it's wet, but second of all, this is where the people live that are the types that want to collect rainwater. In other words, if you're from another part of the country, I sympathize that you don't really... You're not really too interested in collecting rainwater. It's not for drinking. It's for just irrigation. It gets hot and dry in the summer and for months, and you need water. And, you know, water costs money. When I was a kid, water wasn't metered, I'm pretty sure, when I was a kid. I remember my dad, he even modified his whole plumbing system and did some kind of cool stuff there. He put a pressure gauge in his own water system. You know, my dad was a process engineer, like a process control engineer or an instrumentation engineer for pulp mills, oil refineries, and then he taught the subject. Well, what my dad figured out was the average house, the pressure in the water lines is enough to make things leak. And what happens is the washers start to give out, so it starts to drip, and then you start to crank it closed ever more firmly, and then you can no longer stop it from leaking, and now you got water leaking, and then you got to fix your taps. Well, he put a very large valve in. Valves is a whole story in itself, but he put in a main waterline valve, and he could control the total pressure in the house system, and he would only open it up when he opened it up. He would only turn it on to full pressure when he had all the sprinklers going. He would set up like 3 sprinklers, 3 parts of the house, as I mentioned earlier in earlier casts. My dad had half a dozen lawns and half a dozen gardens, and really an awesome place to grow up in. There was just so much going on there. And so he'd set up the sprinklers, come in and turn them on, and then come inside and then jack up the water pressure. right when you needed it, right? You're pumping out maximum water on three hoses at the same time. Then when you're done, you shut off the sprinklers, you wound down the water pressure to whatever the value was that he normally ran it at. And I don't remember. I don't know if anyone on earth remembers anymore. Maybe my older brother might remember what the two pressures were that he ran at. What an elegant solution. Running stuff at a lesser than maximum level. It's really quite a clever concept, and you can apply it in other areas too. I'm racking my brain trying to think of one. I'll give you one. Take an umbrella. Umbrellas, they always, you know, the fabric comes off one of the corners. Always, right? I'm not talking about when the umbrella goes inside out. That's, you know, that's mismanagement of your umbrella. There's ways of, you know, avoiding that. I don't have that happen almost ever, but sure enough, at some point, especially if you have umbrellas for years, you know, the fabric will come off one of the posts, one of the arms, I guess you could call it, of the umbrella. And now it looks kind of ridiculous, right? This big flapping thing there. It's not covering you as well. Then you get a second one like that, and then you throw it out, right? Well, what I do is I repair the part of the umbrella that's come off. I repair it with fish line, so it's very durable. And I deliberately don't tighten it up to that post again. I deliberately have it get within about an inch of that post. I've de-stressed the system on purpose. It's not like it's floppy, but it's not stressed. And as a result, it won't wear out as fast. And, you know, if another one goes, I do the same with that one. And you can feel there's sort of a natural tension that's the right amount of tension. And then you have that umbrella for years. We've got umbrellas here. I've got one that was kind of a nice, like a businessman's black and silver umbrella. Really kind of awesome. And it has a cushiony material in the handle even. I've never even seen that in any other umbrella. Usually they're solid material that you grab onto. This one has like a gel inside there. So it conforms to your hand and it's soft and padded. It's a real quality umbrella. Well, of course, you know, very early on in its life here, one or more of the pieces broke off their posts, and what would you do? Most people would ditch it. I did my little repair, and we still have it floating around here. You know, it's just, that umbrella's 10 years old. It'll be 20, it'll be 30, it won't wear out. And if it does, if something wears, another post wears, do the same repair, same concept. So that's what my dad did with our water system at home, was put in a big valve. A professional level engineering valve and a meter, a gauge, so you could tell what his water pressure was. I mean, how else would you know, right? Most people, we just, you know, we crank it open, we crank it closed, or we're like, that's too much. You know, we don't really know how much it is. So that was great. And you could tell in our house when he was doing all the watering, you could hear the sound of it. You could hear things opened up, the sound of the pressure, and then when he would wind it down, it had a totally different sound. It's one of those great things. My dad gardening in his shorts and nothing else. No socks, no shoes, no shirt. Hairy guy. The hair on his head was very unruly. He looked a bit like Albert Einstein would look if he was gardening. He didn't have quite the gray hair. In the time that I remember him gardening, I guess it might have started to turn a bit gray, but he wasn't the type to go all gray. Maybe because he just was so darn healthy. He's healthy as a horse, that guy. He was always working, always doing something that involved walking, riding your bike, working in the garden, pruning trees. When he was in his 60s, he was pruning orchard trees. And this is something, when you have 2 acres of trees, roughly, I think it was 700 trees. Was it 350 or 700? I forgot now. Let's say 350, maybe. And you got to prune them. It takes months. Well, that's months of exercise. That's the way he was. All right, so water system. So around here, we have to pay for our water. It's metered these days. And we've got a thing here in this area that they're working on the sewer systems, upgrading them, storm sewer system. And this is a very large project. They're working on stuff that you can drive an entire pickup truck through, those size pipes, dealing with runoff water so it doesn't just go in the river and upset the fish. Well, they pass that cost on to the people in the area. And they do it through the sewer, a sewer tax on your bill. And the sewer amount is tied to the water amount. And I think the sewer amount was like triple the water amount. So for every gallon of water you save a gallon of sewer water. times 3 because they're trying to pay for their project. So 1 gallon equals 4 gallons. Well, bottom line is that a gallon of water in this house costs 2.5 cents to buy from the city. When you flush the toilet, typically I think they have at least a gallon. It really varies by toilet. Let's say our toilet, which is not exactly state-of-the-art, let's say it has 2 gallons in it. So 5 cents to flush it. Well, watering, watering plants, turn that hose on, you're gone for 5 or 10 minutes, right? So your toilet uses 2 gallons, and how long does it take to fill up? Even on a narrow inlet line, the inlet line to your toilet is not even the full size of the rest of your house. It's not 1/2 inch, or some people these days have 5/8 or 3/4. The inlet line to the toilet is probably 3/8. Had another moth. Probably hear it banging around. There it is. See if I can get him outside. Well, couldn't get the moth. He sort of disappeared into the woodwork there somewhere. All right, what was I talking about? There he is again. Oh, man, they're so gigantic. It's almost like having a bird in the house. Hang on. They're reading a kid's book to someone I care for, and within the book there's a mention of another book, and that book is called The Moth That Ate Toledo. I've got a moth that's... So, rainwater collection, metered water, and this being an area where this is the kind of thing people do. Oh, and the other thing is that there's a slight rebate on your bill if you manage your downspout water and you don't just send it into the sewer system. They kick you back some money. So in this neighborhood, people do a lot of different things to disperse their water so it doesn't just go into the sewer system. These factors have fueled my desire to do something with our rainwater. It's not just about, cost or saving money. That's really sort of maybe a third of it. A third of it is sort of the challenge of doing something and then keeping up with the Joneses. Not really, but it's environmental, right? Why waste something? Why waste water and then have to pay for water just to throw it onto your plants? Plants don't have a high standard for water. It can come off your roof and go onto your garden, no problem at all. Plants will say thank you very much. Doesn't need chlorination treatment before it goes onto your plants. So it should be a simple problem, but it's sort of interesting that dealing with water, water is surprisingly heavy, and you need a surprisingly large amount of it. Oh yeah, I was talking about flow rates. Your toilet, even though it's going through, a 3/8 inch line, feed line into the toilet, it fills up after you flush in, 1/2 minute. It might even be, 20 seconds, depends on the toilet. So let's say 1/3 of a minute. We estimated 2 gallons in a toilet, so it's about 6 gallons a minute. And this is what they say, is that on a 1/2 inch line, it can have a flow rate of something like 6 gallons a minute. So when you go out and water your garden, if you spend 5 minutes, that's 30 gallons. If you spend 10 minutes, that's 60 gallons. Well, when I was a kid, we used to leave those hoses running for hours. We were putting hundreds of gallons onto the, maybe thousands, maybe 1,000 in one shot. Times have changed, we don't do that. When I think about it, our property, there was growth and green everywhere. It wasn't as hot. We were on the coast, the true coast, where I am now. We're inland a bit, so it wasn't quite as hot. And we got much more rain, which probably is what made it so the water wasn't metered at that time. It was one of the great water systems in the world. This is the Cleveland Dam feeding the Vancouver, British Columbia metro area. So let's say, the average watering is 10 minutes and 6 gallons a minute. That's 60 gallons times 2.5 cents. It's a couple of bucks, something like that. And as I say, you're wasting it on one hand and then you have to buy it on the other hand. Seems crazy. So I looked into the cost of these tanks. They're not cheap. There is no tank or tank-like thing you can get that's a lot cheaper than the rest. Even if it's a septic tank, which sounds dirty and should be cheap. No, there's no difference. If it's a water, special plastic for carrying potable water, as they say, roughly the same cost. And they even have folding tanks that can be used in an emergency so that, you've got a forest fire in the area, the helicopter comes in, he's got that sort of suction hose that he lowers down. You assemble this folding tank and then you fill it from your house. And imagine they go to 5 houses and they set up 5 of these tanks and they fill them. And then the helicopter can come back and suck it from one and go and dump it and suck it from the next and go and dump it. And by the time he's done five of those, he comes back and the first one is ready. You know, it's well known they do that from swimming pools, but they even have folding rectangular tanks, plastic tanks that you can store water in. I looked at those. I looked at all of them yesterday. I researched for, you know, some number of hours. They're all expensive. There's a local guy who sets up rainwater systems, and he even had one that was discounted. It was the last model. I'm off backing it. It was the last model, and he was sort of getting rid of it. And I think it was about half price. Well, bottom line, to install that would be like $500. Well, you're only saving 2.5 cents a gallon. You work it out. I think it's like 10,000 gallons. I'm just doing that quickly off the top of my head. All right, hang on, I'll work it out. 20,000 gallons you would need to get for free, i.e. rainwater, to pay for your tank. A lot of these tanks are like 80-gallon tanks, 60-gallon tanks. Hang on, I finally caught the moth. BRB. Moth taken care of. Happy ending. So 20,000 gallons you would have to get for free to pay for the tank system. Now, if the tank is like the average tank, which are like 80-gallon tanks and 100-gallon, let's say 100-gallon tank, 20,000, you'd have to fill that tank 200 times. Well, the whole filling thing is not exact. How do you do it? You want some of the water going down that downspout to go into your tank. So you need a diversion from the main flow to go into your tank. Well, if it all goes into your tank, what do you do when your tank fills up? Now it's overflowing your tank. Well, now you have a water problem, right? That's what your gutter system was taking care of for you. So you only want some of it to go to your tank. And I've seen some cases where people install just a small hose going to their tank. Well, the problem with that then is you're only saving a small amount of water. And also, no matter what system you have, big hose, small hose, there has to be some manual involvement. There has to be some, okay, we've opened the line, we're filling up our tank. Okay, our tank is almost full, we're going to shut off that line. You can open the line when it's not raining, you can open it in advance. But when you've got enough water in your tank, that's probably because it's raining out. And then you're like, okay, I got to go out and check it. And, oh, it's only half full. And then I got to go out and check it again. Oh, it's 3/4 full. I'm going to close the line now. That's a lot of maintenance. And what if you're not home and you had it left open, because that's what you always do to capture water, and then it fills up and then it keeps going. Now it's sort of flooding in that area, right? So I have seen some very complicated installations, and I don't like plumbing. To me, plumbing by itself is inelegant. If you're going to do it, it should be part of the original design of a house. And that's my rant, by the way. That's the rant portion of this, is that it should be a law that you have to reuse the water that lands on the roof of your house. Or, rather than a law, it's an automatic discount on your water bill if you reuse water on your house. I think part of what they're worried about is they don't want people drinking their rainwater, when in reality that's probably better water than they get from the city, once the city has poisoned it with fluoridation. You know, when you're trying to kill people with fluoridation, you don't really want them finding an alternative, right? Anyway, for whatever mixture of reasons, the other thing is they don't want us to be off the grid, they don't want us to be independent these days. They want to progressively tighten the noose on all of us, and collecting and reusing rainwater is in the category of, nah, there's too many bad things that could happen. That's what they're saying in their boardrooms. But still, it should be part of house design. Insulation is part of house design. You know, a modern house is insulated 100 times better than the houses of yesteryear. It's not a threat to them. They're not trying to poison you with insulation materials. So, it's kind of depressing that everyone is wasting their water. Everyone's being billed by the city. Everyone is forcing the city to create gigantic pipes to take sewer water. Everyone is causing water to poison fish. It's a giant problem that everyone is feeding and no one's really taking on head on, except the guy who gets serious about his collecting his rainwater. Anyway, so as I say, most of the tanks are not that big, but you can get bigger tanks, and you start getting into the, well, that's about as big as we can handle category when you get into around the 200 gallon range, 200 to 300 gallon range. And this local rainwater guy, I looked into his system, and my system started to hourglass while I was recording, doing nothing, you know, and it was like, hey, hang on, I'm busy. And I'm like, why are you busy? And that was my antivirus doing a little check. one of my antiviruses. I have a couple. Recommend that. Don't trust one. What was I talking about? Rainwater collection. I'm a little tired this morning. I worked so hard yesterday and then right into the night. A tiny bit fuzzy this morning. I hope I can remember my train of thought of what I was just talking about. Oh yeah, the size of systems. So bottom line is, a big system these days to collect rainwater is about 250, 275 gallons. And when I looked into exactly that system, that was the system this guy had locally. He had the last one. It was on sale. And it would have cost me a total of about $500 to install it. It just didn't quite pay off. When you work out 20,000 gallons, how long it's going to take? It was like 10 years. It would take 10 years for that system to pay for itself. And again, it's not just about paying for itself. It's sort of like driving a Prius. A Prius doesn't always pay for itself, but it's like,
hey, I'm being good to the environment
kind of thing. But still, you might as well make it pay for itself. And what did it take for it to pay for itself? Just these are just my back-of-the-envelope calculations. In other words, how much water am I going to capture with this system? Because here's the problem with the rainwater system. In the wintertime, and let's call it early spring and late fall, you don't need much rainwater for your garden. You're not really watering your garden then. But you tend to get more. So you only get so much water in the year. And where I live here, in the summertime, it can go months without raining. That's sort of a problem. When you need it, it's not raining. So there is a solution to that, and that is get a bigger tank. Which is why I was looking at that 275-gallon one. Let's not fool around. But still, you can only fill it so many times. And so I estimated I would fill it about once a month. Because you do get summer rainfalls, and they can be heavy. If it runs for half an hour, it's probably enough to come close to filling that tank. So what I needed, I realized yesterday, was I needed a cheaper tank. So anyway, I headed on. First I researched what kind of tanks were there. That's when I found out about the folding ones and the septic ones and all the different ones. These are thousands of dollars. Some of them. But for sure, they started about $300. Go on to Craigslist and they were like $150. And there's a lot of fish tanks, which are not useful. And then there's a lot of these, you know, 80-gallon tanks and 60-gallon tanks, which are just too small. Well, I ran across a tank yesterday that was 275 gallons, exactly the model that I had been looking at from the local rainwater guy, so I knew it was a good thing. And it was for a good price. So I phoned the guy, had to leave a message, he just, you know, went to voicemail. And then I sort of waited a few minutes, and I realized, hey, what are the odds of this guy phoning you back? Like, this is a better deal than average. This thing's already been scarfed up by somebody, right? And then he gets nothing but phone calls, and he's like, I'm not even going to answer the phone. So I had a nap. Not a big nap, half an hour or whatever it was. And I'm coming out of the nap and just watching the world go by and gradually get ready to get up. And the phone rings. It's the guy. And, yeah, he's still got the tank. Tells me where it is. I'm like, I'm on my way. It's a bit of an adventure to get there. He lives on a hill, which ties into why he got this tank. I had to go off a regular road. 16% grade. I think the limit on the interstate, I may be wrong, but I think the limit is 6%. You will not encounter a hill on the interstate that's more than 6%. And in Canada, I've seen in British Columbia, you'll see 8% for main highway. And there is one particular road, I think you have one spot on that road, I think it gets to 11. It's a secondary highway near Agassiz in British Columbia. It's a little chunk of road, might be a half a mile. And it feels like you're going up in an elevator. It's really something else. When I first started working on the railway, first started driving a truck on the railway, they just said, you know, here's the truck, you need to go to Kamloops, as it happened, 250 miles away. You know, get going. No training, nothing. It's a 3.5-ton truck, they called it. Maximum vehicle weight, 24,000. That was sort of the category where you didn't need a special license. So, of course, the railway being ultra cheap, CP Rail, Canadian Pacific Railway. That's the kind of trucks they had everywhere so that anyone could drive them. So I'm going along, I'm around Agassiz, I'm going down this hill now, and the truck pops out of gear. Because, like, I'm the type to use the gears to be conservative. So I got it in gear, and I'm like, okay, it's all good. I know this is a steep hill, and it pops out of gear. Anyway, I'm just this, you know, relatively young kid. I think I might have been like 20, 21, 22, something like that. And suddenly I'm on a super steep hill, and the last thing I want is for the truck to pop out of gear. I'm counting on those gears to regulate my speed.
So I just popped in the clutch, jammed it back in the gear, and then I just held it in gear. It was like, well, what else can I do? And it turned out that worked. Anyway, so, you know, 11%, and that's a very noticeable hill. Well, 16%? I think what that means is for every 100 feet you go horizontally, you go 16 feet vertically. So it's literally 1/6 of an elevator ride. It's 1/6 of going straight up. I have a pretty good truck. I had it in bull low at one point. This is on a main road. I had it in my lowest gear, which can only go like 15 or 20 miles an hour tops. And the truck was like, hey, look, I don't normally do this. Are you planning on making this a regular occurrence? And I'm like, no. Just this one time, I promise. Then I get to the top of the hill, and I figure, okay, he's on the other side. I had looked at the Google Maps, and in that area, it looked like he was in the center of it, so I figured he was on the top of the hill, and he was like, yeah, that's right. Well, it turned out, on the other side, you had to go down. So I'm going down this little road, and then I'm right where his place should be, and it's not there. There's an abandoned house, that's not him. There's a house that's not the right address, and I talked to the guy, and he's like, oh, yeah, you got to do this and that and the other thing. Well, he lives on a road that should have been a differently named road. Oh, dear. You know, anyway. So, I find this place. It's on the true top of the hill. And he has a super steep driveway. I mean, I cannot imagine this area in the wintertime, how they get around. But get up there, and it's a very large place. It turned out the house was built and owned by the guy who started Net Zero. Net Zero was an internet access company in the days when we used to use dial-up, right? Modems, phone lines, and, you know, you've got mail. Along with AOL, America Online, there was Net Zero. America Online charged you $20 a month, CompuServe charged you whatever, $20 a month, and most of the independent ISPs charged you $20 a month, and then Net Zero was zero cost per month. And you had to look at advertisements. He was kind of ahead of his time, right? Because, you know, advertisements are really dominating the internet now. It's like hard to get away from them. There's all kinds of tracking of you going on because the tracking is worth money. By the way, I have no tracking on my website. There's no need for JavaScript on my website with the exception of my baby names query page. You know, you type in your name and it'll analyze that name and then it'll take you to the appropriate page. That takes a little bit of JavaScript. But if you don't use it, well, it just won't work. You can do it manually once you know how to do it. If you want that little bit of calculation, you need JavaScript turned on. So this guy started Net Zero. That's kind of amazing. So this place was worth more than $1 million, big house, ranch styles. And then he built this other house, which was going to be a bed and breakfast. And it looks like a fire hall. He built a fire hall behind his house. It's gigantic, gigantic garage. All these bays in it. People could live there independently and he could make money from that. It's kind of fascinating how people come up with these ideas. He spent $800,000 just in the cost of this fire hall, this gigantic building that he built. And I'm telling you, where that's located, I wouldn't want to stay there. Not a chance. Just the hills alone. Forget it. Anyway, it didn't all work out. And Mr. Net Zero, he had other business ventures and he had to make a choice at one point. And because as we know, Net Zero sort of died off, right? Because the people like Comcast and in Canada, Rogers Cable and Shaw Cable, you know, your cable provider started providing your internet. And it was higher speed. And also the phone lines became DSL, which was like a kind of a clunky hack. The phone company came up with it, gave speed somewhere between your phone line and cable like Comcast. Anyway, they took over the market. And so you didn't need an independent ISP. It was part of your cable company, who now charges $50 a month, right? You know, you sort of still do need a cheap one, but it gets complicated, right? If you want TV and telephone and internet, you can get a bundle, and it's cheaper. You know, it depends what your needs are. The average person, Comcast, is the solution around these parts. So he had now put in like something like $3 million into this whole operation, and he had to sell it. And so anyway, the reason I was up there, he was moving out. He was a renter. He had been staying there renting. And the reason he got the tank was they're on a well. They get well water there. And I guess that the pump on the well was on the fritz. And then the owner, Mr. Net Zero or whoever, they were like, well, we're not going to fix it because we're losing the place. So we're not going to put more money into it only to lose that. So now this guy had no water.
And then his son was having a birthday party, and he's like, what am I going to do? He goes and buys this gigantic tank. Now you got water. And then after that, well, now you don't need this tank, right? And he was literally moving when I got there. He had his U-Haul truck, and he was loading it up. And I'm sure that this tank was like, if he had to, he was just going to leave it. So I was like, well, back it up. Two of us loaded in there. Probably weighs like 100 pounds. And I got myself a tank for way less than everyone else was selling them for. Drive home with it. And now I'm like, okay, now what? So I locked the tank. It's lockable because it's got this steel frame around it, aluminum frame around it. I lock it to my truck because I'm like, maybe I won't do anything about it today and work on it tomorrow or whatever. I don't want something to come along and take it. Yeah, I'm a little paranoid. Where we're located is kind of a higher than normal traffic area. It's right near a fast road. And this has happened a few times where someone comes in and they do something and then they can get back on the fast road and they can take off. So for targets of opportunity, we're kind of like the first target. We've had some, just a couple of little things happen that in themselves are not that big, but it just shows you this is not an average home. It's a little bit more higher risk than some of the others. For example, now that I think about it, last week we'd gone shopping. It was Tuesday. It was Costco shopping. Came back with the kids. I can't park in my spot because there's a giant branch there. And the branch is all like scarred up one side, like freshly ripped off bark. And what had happened was some truck broke this branch, hit it with the truck, broke it right off. And, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you go, oh, well, and you'd push the branch to the side of the road and you'd carry on, right? Well, in this day and age, in this area, in the West Coast, you break someone's branch, they're like, I'm going to sue you. They make a big deal out of it, right? So what do you do when you break it? You take the branch, because then they don't immediately notice that you've broken it. Plus, if your truck is moving and you've broken this branch and it, I mean, you can quickly load it on your truck, or maybe it's even stuck to your truck. And if you just keep going, no one's going to notice. By the time they figure it out, you've gone, and they can't get your license plate and all of that. So now he's going on that fast highway nearby, right? And then he's like, okay, I got to ditch this branch. And so he randomly pulls off. And now when you ditch it, provided no one sees you, no one's going to put it all together. And so sure enough, I actually went riding in the area to see, was there a tree that had recently lost a branch? Because if there was, I was going to give him the branch back. It's like, you deal with this. I don't want it. Well, there was no tree in the neighborhood. So I was like, okay, fine. So I just, you know, take the little leaves off, put them in our recycle bin, and it wasn't a problem. The bigger wood, I'll burn it in our backyard fire pit. And I've already burned all of it except for the big main trunk, and then my wife cleverly came up with a use for the big main trunk, and, you know, problem solved. All right, so that's why I locked the tank to my truck. Basic paranoia based on where I live here, being a little bit higher profile than normal. So then I'm going to get the area ready. I know where I want it to go. I measure it, and it can just fit, because we have a sort of a bush, a flowering bush that, I'm going to say hydrangea. I'm going to pretend I know something about plants. I'm going to say we have a hydrangea bush that's limiting one side of the area. And so I level it, and then I happen to have recovered some cinder blocks. Someone was doing a massive clean from their backyard. They had a bin. They had a dumpster, a waste management bin on the street, and they were filling up. And whenever I see that, I always want to check it out, and I want to see what's going on, because you never know. Well, it turned out they had all these cinder blocks in the back, and they had sort of a weird structure. Bottom line is they didn't want any of that anymore. And some of them were painted, which is kind of nice. It means it's they'll last longer, and they look nicer. And so I packed all these home in my truck, quite an effort, and set them up in the backyard, kind of similar to what they had done, which was just a way to store it. But it looked nice by putting them into sort of a cubish, cube, half-cube shape. And then you could sit on it. It was near the fire pit. You could sit on it. They doubled as seating. And problem solved, and I've got something that I can use later on, right? Well, a couple of years go by, and now I realize, hey, because I need a base for this water tank. And I have a lot of wood, as I mentioned, and I could have made it out of wood, but wood can rot. And it can get a little rickety when you're making something 2 feet high. You either have to make a frame or you stack it. And if you stack it, it can get rickety. So I went, hey, these cinder blocks might be pretty good. And this tank has an unusual frame. It has very strong legs. I think it has, working it out, 3, 6, 7, 8 legs. Very heavy duty.
And then it has underneath these legs, so in other words, the part that actually touches the ground or wherever you put it on, is tubular aluminum half inch. So it's not particularly strong, it's not particularly wide, and it's right at the perimeter of the tank. So you have to design around that. That's what's going to be touching whatever you put it on. And it's this perimeter dimension. Well, the problem with that in the area I was putting in, which was kind of tight, is it meant I had to have a base that was as wide as that perimeter all the way down to the ground, right, for strength and stability and all that jazz. So luckily I just fit it in. Anyway, got all these center blocks, and I realized because of this kind of sort of wonky way that this tank is designed, there's no center support. It's all on the perimeter. So I went, I'm building a wall. I'm building like a miniature castle is what I'm doing. Two levels of cinder blocks around the perimeter of this tank. Well, this tank is 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet. It's big. When it's filled, it will hold 2,200 pounds of water. That's a lot. Anyway, so leveled the area, put the cinder blocks down, and some of the ones that were painted, they're painted like a dark green. Well, perfect. I put them in the most visible part of the base, you know, the part everyone's going to see walking by, and now it just looks green like the garden, right? Anyway, so now I got the base done. This person even had some sort of cap pieces. They used them to cap the cinder blocks. Well, they're nice and strong, they're nice and thick, and they look nice, they're painted. And then I capped the corners of the wall so that it was a wall, a cube square wall. And then on the corners, I had these caps that sort of made it like a bigger footing, right? So that's nice so that when you're putting the tank on it, it's got a bigger purchase. It's got a bigger surface to land on. You know, just enhance the stability. And it distributes the load a little bit too. Because when you got 2,000 pounds, 500 on each corner, right? You're distributing 500 pounds. That's like three of me standing on each corner. It's just a heavy operation. You got to over-engineer it, if anything. So now I've got this tank in the back of my truck, and I got to get it onto this platform. What the heck? How am I going to do that? So I went, and I was measuring, you know, and thinking, and I went over to the, and I had a wheelbarrow, my wheelbarrow. And I thought, if I can get the tank onto the wheelbarrow, I can wheel it into place. And I'm trying to do this by myself, by the way. And I'm not fully committed to doing it by myself, but I'm trying to do that. And I'm sort of laughing that, even though it's a fairly busy area, not many people were going by, you know, I wasn't getting a helper coming along going, hey, it looks like you need a hand. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, I can wiggle it off the back of the truck and lower it onto this wheelbarrow, which might tip over, admittedly. I could give it a shot. And then as a backup, I realized, let's say it misses the wheelbarrow while I'm still holding one end, I just lower it to the ground. And now I can wiggle it or walk it the 50 feet to the area where I'm going to be putting it. Didn't sound like all that much fun. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm just trying to be, I was sort of in just a good headspace, just kind of a relaxed, thinking about the problem headspace. Bang, light bulb. I realized, hey, wait a minute, I got a truck. Why don't I drive my truck on my property? And you know, there's a curb, and there's a bit of a hill, you know, to where I wanted it to go. And there's, you know, various things in the way. But I just thought, hey, you know, the grass is, at this time of year, the grass is kind of dormant. We have kind of clay soil, not the greatest soil, so the soil is really hard. And I thought between things being dry and hard, I thought I probably won't chew up the lawn that much, you know. I certainly won't sink into it, not with clay. So, next thing you know, I'm driving the truck onto the property. I have to go back and forth a few times to get it all lined up, and then bang, I am right next to my platform where I want it to be. I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Well, because there's a bit of a hill, my truck is sort of pointed down the hill, and I have to wiggle this tank up the hill, which I do. And I have to turn it on 180 degrees, because I had transported it with its spout, the bottom spout, facing the rear of the truck. I didn't really think about it too far, but I did think that I wanted it to be where I could see it so I wouldn't bang into it or whatever and damage it. Well, now I had to turn it around, because now I wanted the spout facing me again, but the tank had to go through 180 degrees to get it the way I wanted it. So I turned it around on the tailgate of the truck, and then I start inching it off. It gets to the point where it wants to tip, so I jump off the truck, and I'm pulling it from the ground. And you sort of have to commit at some point, and you just pull it, and it kind of lands with a thud on the platform. And there I stood. I had it halfway off the truck tailgate and half on the platform, and I had a problem because I was running out of room. I had the truck so close And when it tips, when the tank tips, it takes up more width than when it's vertical. Take a cube, take a Rubik's cube, and tip it sideways, and you'll see that that cube is now wider than when the cube is upright. Well, by this tank being tipped and sideways, it was now taking up more space, and bottom line is I couldn't get it off my truck. I could pull the truck forward, but what would happen? The tank would do who knows what, because it wasn't far enough onto the platform that as I drove forward, it would just settle on the platform. It would be half off the platform, and it might fall off the platform. I'm now doing another one of my thinking things. I'm sitting there looking at it going, now what, right? And at that moment, I hear, what you doing, mister? My wife had just come home. She was going to be coming home around 8:30 at night. And I'm like, what are you doing home so early? It's like 6 o'clock or something, right? She said, no, it's 8 o'clock. I've been working on this project all day. The time had just flown by. So the next thing you know, she's able to hold this part of the tank. I can drive the truck out of the way. And we jiggle here and jiggle there. It's in place. Tank is installed. Well, afterwards, I was so pumped up. It felt like 5 or 6 p.m. I had 3 or 4 hours a day left of me, and it was like 9 o'clock. We normally go to bed at 9 o'clock, 8:30 to 9:30. So anyway, it took a while to wind down, and finally I was able to go to bed, and I got me a water tank for a deal. So I figured this thing, if I can fill it up once a month in the summer months when I need it, that is, it'll pay for itself in a couple of seasons. And that's more like it, right? Kind of awesome. When I wrote down my notes, because I have a big long story that I typed in on all this, which I hardly referred to at all, I was thinking, well, that's a 10-minute story, and I'll do all these other things I usually do. Well, here we are, in raw recording time, 52 minutes in. All right, let's switch into update mode. This was a little soccer update that I wasn't expecting to have. A guy, Michael Bradley, he was one of the guys in the U.S. World Cup team, and he plays for Toronto in the MLS, Major League Soccer League, North American League. Anyway, he was complaining about the officials last night. He was going on and on. Well, you know, I've written my piece on soccer now, and I'll be turning it into a video in the next week or two here. You know, I've written about what soccer needs. You're not going to get a good soccer game these days. It is not available with the way the game is structured. It must change. Anyway, just kind of topical, the areas. He's probably taking a professional risk, maybe even a financial risk, by complaining to the level that he's complaining about the officiating. There it is, good old soccer, messed up soccer. Hey, did I mention that all my podcast links are live and online? I also just sort of cleaned things up there. I had all my podcasts in one page, and I realized, hey, I can put some into the history page, and then just have like the last three, say, because my pod page does double duty. It has the MP3s of my videos. So originally I had everything. Now the older Floydcasts are on their own page, which will always be an exhaustive page. It'll always have all Floydcasts in one page with descriptions and you name it. It's just awesome to have something you want to do. You can see a benefit of doing it. It sort of nags at you. You know it's not going to be a 5-minute job, and then eventually you get it done. There's a great sense of accomplishment there. All right, next story. Chief Ebola doctor overseeing cases in Sierra Leone contracts the virus. So a doctor helping people who are victims of the dreaded Ebola in Africa, he contracts the disease. That's a story on CNN. I'll have the link available when I put the latest links onto the, call it the pod link page. Well, what's the guy's name? Sheikh Umar Khan. And his first name is Sheikh, S-H-E-I-K. Middle name Umar, H-U-M-A-R-R. And the last name Khan, K-H-A-N. Now, you got to say, this kind of thing is a very humanitarian thing. Well, what's the most humanitarian quality? The kind of quality that's willing to be in this kind of an area and do this kind of thing? Well, that's the five quality. The five supports the underdog. A classic name for this kind of thing is Jim. I remember meeting a Jim once. He was collecting money for the crippled children. And he had a little spiel. He said all that in about half a second. Over and over again. And he was outside of a Safeway. At the time, I was forced to shop at Safeway. That's all I'll say about that entity.
And so he had a good spot, a good yuppie spot to beg for money for his crippled children. Beg is not the right word. To try and get money to help. But that's the five. That's a gym. They care so deeply, and they're so intense, and they're so driven. So here's this doctor. Let's look at his name. Sheik, first name, S-H-E-I-K, 527. Accident looking for a place to happen. Well, of course, that's the story, right? Normally, doctors don't catch the diseases they're treating, right? Well, he did. Well, his name says he's gonna, right? And then you go, well, are there any other fives around? Because, I mean, okay, he's got a five in the first name. That's that humanitarian quality. Or it's humanitarian is not the right word. They want to help the underdog. They want to right an injustice. Like for this guy, he's looking at this whole thing as an injustice. We have the rich and the poor, right? And the rich have everything and they want more, and the poor have nothing, and then they die, right? Bothers the five quality. Well, with Khan, which is a 1-6-7, he has a 6-8-5 total, five destiny. There you go. So, poor guy, five destiny, of course, is an accident destiny, and he has an accident, right? He catches the disease. All right, my counterbalancing name story. Someone with a good name. Well, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to use Yasiel Puig again. Because he did something amazing again. This guy, this natural, amazing guy. In this last week, I forget which day, he hit three triples and a double in one game. Now, to get four hits in one game is rare. Five is, I think it might be the limit. Just because you only go up to bat, you know, maybe five times at the most, right? In a typical game. So that means you had to get a hit every time. Well, the best hitters get a hit one-third of the time. So the best hitters get between one and two hits per game. Well, Yasiel Puig got four. But they weren't four singles. There weren't four doubles. There were three triples and a double. Well, this hasn't happened in 100 years. Something like that. Something very long. Or four people did it in the last 100 years. Something like that. Well, Mr. Puig, our featured good name of the day guy, he did it. And this is only his second year in the league. You know, what's he going to do when he gets good? All right, Donald Sterling update. Haven't talked about this dude in a while. Well, he's suing everybody. He refuses to leave the Clippers. And now he's putting people in an awkward position. The coach of the Clippers, Doc Rivers. By the way, he has Doc Rivers, which is what he normally goes by. He's got a five destiny. So he's perpetually having bad things happen to him, unfair things happen to him. And then with that five destiny, things rankle you. You know, you can't just take it. And of course, as Glenn Doc Rivers, he's got that accent looking for a place to happen. First name. And so it's kind of like no matter what he does now, things might not work out well. He's really in the middle of it here. Well, he's already on the record as saying that he will not coach. He will quit if this Mr. Sterling doesn't leave the entire operation. Well, you got to picture this. This Donald Sterling has already sold his team for $2 billion. A team he bought for, I forget what it was. It was between like 10 and 30 million. I think it was like 15 million. So it went from 15 million to 2 billion, roughly a factor of 100. Every dollar you put in, he's getting $100 back out. Why is he suing anybody? Isn't $2 billion enough? Of course it is. It wasn't worth that. The market value was estimated at like, you know, $600 to $800 million. So he's getting 2 to 3 times what the team is worth. That's just interesting. I'm sure there are other reasons for why he's doing this. I don't think it's to do with that he really does want to leave. I don't think that's it at all. This guy's got a way to make some more money out of this situation. Well, anyway, there's poor Doc Rivers stuck in a corner. He said he'll quit if the guy doesn't take a hike. And now the guy's not taking a hike. Awkward. The situation continues. Everyone continues to suffer. As I, you know, predicted right when this first happened. All right, I'm going to do a Formula One update and then try and get to my other weeks. So the Formula One race this weekend, another one. I'm trying to remember where this one is. It might be the, for some reason I want to say the Austrian Grand Prix. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly. It would kind of make sense because last week was Germany. Austria's right next door. All right, so qualifying. They have a number of days of qualifying. The idea in qualifying is you want to rank the cars. You want the fastest cars at the front. It would be unfair if a fast car was behind a slow car, right? It can actually be quite hard to pass in Formula One. The tracks, some of them especially, are very, very hard to pass.
So you want to have people qualify, you want the fastest cars in the front, and then they typically don't have to pass, right? You do get a bit of passing for a couple of reasons. One is they have to do a pit stop, and then they may or may not get back out in time, and then someone passes them, right? And that's okay. You want some of that. The other reason is they've introduced something called DRS, which I don't remember what the acronym stands for. Basically, it's a zone where when you are trailing behind another car, and everything, all the conditions are right, you're within 1 second of them. In other words, you're trying to pass them. In certain zones on the track, the race officials will enable DRS, which basically means you can open like a flap or whatever on your vehicle, and you can get a slight performance advantage to pass them. Kind of awesome. Kind of a smart innovation. And so that's another way that people can pass other people. So anyway, Formula One is just so primo, man. I'd love to work in Formula One. It just appeals to my need for speed. And also just all the intricacies and being such a supremely slick operation. Their pit stops. A slow pit stop these days in Formula One is 3 seconds. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, you're back out on the road going 200 miles an hour. Wow. When they pit stop, there's like a dozen people are there, at least. You know, in NASCAR, it's, you see one guy in a jack and he whips around to the other side and they only change two tires and yada yada because they have limits to make it a little bit more exciting. Well, with Formula One, it's not exciting. It's how to describe it. It happens so quickly. Any sort of normal thing that we normally think of takes longer. I was thinking of a mailman delivering something and going away. It would be like a forklift coming in, lowering down a pallet, and then driving away. That's probably the best analogy. And you could probably do that in 3 seconds. Well, they do everything. They jack the car up. They stop it, you know, from a high speed. They jack it up. Out go the tires, in go the tires. I think they now have enough fuel for the whole race. I may be wrong, but I think they do. And that's kind of a good thing. You know, the whole fuel thing, that's just a good way to have a problem, right? If they have to make wing adjustments, they do it. And it all happens in those under 3 seconds. And 2.2 is pretty common, like basically 2 seconds, the whole thing. So the races this weekend, so qualifying, really important. Last week, Lewis Hamilton had an accident in qualifying, puts him at the back of the pack. He started in 20th. Well, Lewis Hamilton, this year, Mercedes, his team, is doing really well. Him and his teammate for Mercedes. And Lewis Hamilton gained back. I think he got back to 5th. It was around there. He might even have been on the podium. I think he might have got back to 2nd from 20th. This is in a race where you're lucky to pass at all. And he did 18 passes. Whoa, man. You know, it helps that he has a better than average car. The Mercedes cars this year, they've done a whole bunch of other changes in Formula One and made it, you know, everything much more intricate, but, it, you know, more interesting. Anyway, so Mercedes, I think, was, you know, sort of ahead of everybody else on the engineering curve. That's why they have an advantage this year. But yesterday in qualifying, or whenever I saw it, it might have been 2 days ago, it was the very first moments of qualifying. And I guess if you have a major malfunction, then your qualifying is over and you go to the back of the pack type thing. Well, get ready for this. Qualifying starts 2 seconds later. Alejandro Maldonado for the Lotus team, his car malfunctions. And that's it. He pulls off the track and he is done. The commentators were beside themselves. It's probably a record. 2 seconds and you're done. So I'm going, all right, let's have a look at the name here. Alejandro, 347. This, whenever you have that 7 bottom number, it's like they almost are successful. Maldonado, the last name, Maldonado. Well, you can guess what combination it is. 527, accident, looking for a place to happen. But it gets better or worse. When you add Alejandro and Maldonado together, you get an 865 total. Now, the 865 is that Mission Impossible quality. And you can see why he's in racing. It's really probably a very good name for racing. But 865-5 Destiny. Accident Destiny. Well, this guy had a malfunction, an accident looking for a place to happen. You name it, in the first 2 seconds of qualifying. The announcer was sort of beside himself and was interviewing him. And like, they were saying how he's so unlucky and how come you're so unlucky and everything else. Well, you know, there it is.
in black and white in the name, right? Exactly as predicted. Okay, so Lewis Hamilton, who had a bad experience last week. Minutes later, his car catches fire. That's it. His qualifying is done. Because what it is they have rounds of qualifying. Again, it's very well thought out that you want the field to be stratified. In other words, you want to make sure that you truly have the fastest first, and then the middle group, and then the slowest group. And so it's like only out of 25 teams or 24 teams, 20 advance four are dropped out, and then at the next round of qualifying, so many are dropped out. And it's very fair, basically. Well, these guys, they didn't even get through any qualifying, and so they will be in the final four. If I'm not mistaken, Lewis Hamilton will be the second last car in the grid. So last week he started 20th. This time he's going to start 23rd. Well, what's his name? Lewis 595. Well, that's an excellent quality and a bad luck quality. Hamilton 742. What's his total? 347. 7 Destiny. Almost gets that success. But if you notice, I mean, it's hard for you to notice. I'm looking at the two that I've analyzed and written down the numbers right in front of me. So Alejandro, who had his problem, had a 347 first name. Lewis Hamilton has a 347 total. So they have the exact same combination. Alejandro Maldonado had a 5 Destiny. Lewis, in Lewis Hamilton, Lewis is 595. So they both had the 5, they both had the 347. I mean, and then in their other name, Maldonado and Hamilton, there's a 7. I mean, the similarity in their numbers is pretty high for a fluke. What would it take for that to be that way, you know, by coincidence? Well, it would take one chance in 1,000 or something like that. Anyway. All right, that's my quick Formula One update. Toxic update. This was a big one. Headline. Most prescribed back medication doesn't reduce pain or shorten recovery. The link from abc.net.au, I guess an Australian website, in the link, the words in the link say, paracetamol no more effective than placebo. Well, paracetamol is acetaminophen. And I talk about paracetamol, acetaminophen, and even the more readily known commercial product in my toxic document. And here's the thing. Paracetamol, one dose is 1,000. I got this memorized, 1,000 milligrams, 1 gram. That's your normal dose. The maximum daily dose is 4,000, and some people got liver failure at 6,000. Well, of course, these days they have like liquid versions of the product, and they start slipping it into other things. Well, when you got a liquid, you got a potential for someone drinking it. You got a potential for someone being a little more careless with the product. You got a kid who opens up the medicine cabinet and knocks back some, we'll call it paracetamol, liquid acetaminophen, we'll call it. And you got a potential problem there. Well, how about that this pain reliever is no better than placebo? You know, I am gotta say, I've never had much respect for acetaminophen. I've never taken it. And for some reason, just my gut. Well, of course, what's interesting, we care for people, and people that I work with, and myself and my wife. And, you know, they go to doctors, and it's all done sort of professionally. They have, sometimes they'll have a medical officer for the company, or you have a nurse who runs the company in some cases. You've got someone who's really qualified. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone give, that's the trade name for this product, or acetaminophen. I don't think I've ever seen anyone give acetaminophen to anybody. It's not prescribed, it's not used. Interesting. You learn quite a bit from working in the care business. Most of it is not good, but some of it is good and useful. So there it is. Paracetamol, they describe the study and everything. I'll have the link up. The stuff doesn't work. And you are always, it's one of the most close to the point of for sure harm of any product that you regularly encounter in the workplace or in your home, with the exception of smoking, drinking, energy shots, fluoride, and microwave radiation. Those are the biggest toxins, the biggest threats that I talk about. And of course, I talk about, 20 other things, but those are the big ones. And here it is, one of the big ones doesn't even work in this study for back pain. Doesn't even work. Oh my goodness. what is this product doing in the marketplace? You know, there was a time when this kind of result would cause it to be removed from the marketplace. Oh, dear. Oh, I'll serve a little correction here. I just realized I thought I had another Formula One note where I talked about the announcer and the bad luck the guy was having. It was another guy in qualifying who had an accident. Felipe Massa. Felipe, F-E-L-I-P-E, which is a no-problem kind of name, 178. Massa, M-A-S-S-A, 268. So the names by themselves, no big deal. Except, what's the guy's total? 3-4-7. Exactly like the other two people I just talked about. So he had troubles in qualifying. Three different F1 drivers, each of them having a 3-4-7 in a critical position, two of them having it in the total, and they have trouble in qualifying. Well, because Felipe Massa didn't have that accident looking for a place to happen, name or a 5, I thought, that's interesting. There's something else going on. So I went and found his birthday on Wikipedia, worked out his cycle. What cycle was he in on that training day this last week? First of all, he's born April 25, 1981. So you added the month, the day, plus 2014, plus 1. When you do all that, he's in a 1 cycle. 1-2 months. I'm like, what the heck? That's a good month of a good year. Well, what day was he in? He was in a 3-4 day. Let me tell you, a 3-4 day is a very testy day. My brother, my oldest brother, electrician, almost died from working with electricity, and I worked it out, and he was in a 3-4 day. It might have been a 4-3. They're basically the same. But I think it was a 3-4 day of a 1 year. He almost died. My brother, for some reason, was always sort of a bit nonchalant with things. I don't know why. His last name, you know, it's got the 3 quality in it. And the 3 can be sort of a shrug of the shoulders attitude. And, of course, he survived this incident. So he was lucky. And that's the 3 as well. So they're a little careless, but they survive. Unlike the 5 quality. Well, he was working on this electrical panel. And he hadn't taken off the power. And he had live wires. And he had tucked one of the live wires behind the panel. And it just, you know, wires are springy. And it just popped out from behind the panel. Well, I have a story from the 3-4 day. Right when I was learning about the cycles. I was learning the cycles. I was in 1 year as well. And I was in like a 3-4 day. A 3-4 month, I think it was. And then it was like a 3-4 day. And I had a cycle book at that time. And the cycle book even said, between this time and this time on this day is super adverse. Because it's like the 3-4 hour, the 3-4 day, or the 3-4 month type thing. Something along those lines. Well, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. So I was like, well, I'm not going anywhere. You know, I'm just gonna stay at home. I was making soup or something like that. I was making something on the stove. It's probably porridge. I'm always baking porridge on the stove. And, you know, hot plate kind of a thing where I was batching at that time. It wasn't fancy. And my bedroom was right next. The kitchen was in the center. A guy had a bedroom on the other side. It was like the attic, converted attic. And the kitchen was in the center, and then I had my bedroom on the other side. And it was kind of a nice, big, grand old house and kind of pretty area. So the rooms were surprisingly big, even though it was an attic, because it was such a big house. It was kind of a nice setup, a kind of sweet setup. And that's where I learned about the principle from this guy who I was sharing the attic with. So I'm trying to get through this really super testy time, right? And I'm thinking, well, nothing's going to happen to me. And literally I had the thought in my mind, like, why do they have a recommendation like that when they could just say, don't go driving? You know, that was sort of percolating in my mind, like, how bad can it get? As Top Gear sometimes says, famously says, you know, how hard can it be? And of course it turns out it's their usual disaster. Well, I boiled the pot dry. I was in my room doing something. An hour goes by or whatever, and I smell something, or I open the door, or my roommate tells me, and the pot is ruined. But isn't that so perfect? Those cycles will find you. So, Felipe Massa, F1 qualifying, the same 3-4-7 as the other two that had problems, has a problem on his 3-4 day. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. So it's 3-for-3 in the F1, and they all were in either a bad cycle or had the kind of name that's going to attract this kind of thing. All right, my of the week's bad driver of the week. This is like a story headline. Impatient drivers had it right all along. The link on Ars Technica, a site that I currently avoid and I have issues with, but nonetheless, some other site mentioned this story and it happened to be hosted there. The link on the story says, "The beauty of zipper merging," or "Why you should drive ruder in a more rude fashion." Quote, "The zipper merge is the safest and fastest way for two lanes of traffic to merge. The zipper merge is the polite name for those rude drivers that cruise to the head of the soon-to-be-closed lane and then merge with polite drivers at the last minute, cutting off and, quote, delaying, quote, all the polite drivers who move to the remaining lane as soon as they see the lane reduction signs." Well, what's interesting about this story is, of course, last week, when I talked about my two lanes merging into one and the bus in front of me merging and everyone else merging, no problem, and then the bus driver behind me road raging me as I merged in exactly this fashion. This zipper merge at the last minute merging in. And anyway, I didn't quote the rest of the article in my notes here, but it's worth reading. I'll have the link. Basically, they say they've tried all kinds of systems and they researched the whole thing and everything else, and this is the safest, very best way to do it. Isn't that beautiful? Alright, this was a bit of a treat, my re-listen of the week. For the last 4 Floydcasts, I haven't had a re-listen of the week, so I'm going to make up for it this week. I happened to get a DVD from the library called Coldplay Live 2012. So they went on a tour, and they recorded a live performance. Now, I have to say, there are a few things worse in the music business than listening to a live performance, watching it on a DVD. First of all, you're not there. They're not larger than life. The quality, it's filmed in the dark, right? So it doesn't film very well. Ugh, just the quality in general is horrible. They don't play like they did in their studio. You name it. Well, this documentary and performance was different because it was a documentary and concert. And they mixed it. They didn't have, like, documentary plus we got 3 videos you can watch on the side. They merged it all together. And so they would perform as part of their tour. They'd show you, you know, where that particular recording was, what city. And then they would talk for a bit and just show you, you know, the usual milling about, as the English say. And they say some stuff. And then, bang, they're back in their performance. And this went on for an hour. And I was looking for one song. There's one Coldplay song that I particularly like. Well, I'm Not Alone. It's their most popular song. So I'm just stepping through the documentary and sort of watching, getting the general feel for it. And then I get to a point where they do the little stunt that's become popular of late, where with these stadiums, they have an outer ring of the donut, where that's how you move around the dome. And then you go in to where your seats are. Well, they leave the stage, they jump into their little electric vehicles, and they race to some prearranged part of the dome through the outer ring. And then they appear, and yay, they're going to do a performance in the audience, right? I saw Taylor Swift doing this. It was pretty awesome. Anyway, these guys do their thing, and it's some, you know, acoustic guitar. They had some backup, but anyway, they do some song. Nothing special in the song. And, you know, you've seen it before. Well, then, the song's over. They don't have a fancy way of getting back to the stage. They proceed to just walk through the crowd back to the stage. They had like 50 burly bouncers holding the people back. And they just walk along. And they're just walking along like they're strolling down a trail. These guys don't look like drug-addled, as they say. They don't look like Keith Richards. You know, they look like pretty normal dudes. They're just tripping along. And these guys in the crowd are patting them on the back and everything, and they're just walking along, looking around. And it felt good. It felt interesting. And a little, you know, sort of more human than average, a little less gimmick and more human. They get back to the stage. There's sort of an undertone of, you know, something's going to happen. You know, they got my interest. And they start playing the song that I love of theirs, Clocks. They start playing Clocks. And Clocks starts with piano. Very familiar notes, and then there's like a driving sort of a bass that accompanies it, and then the guy sings, you know, the song. It's just this awesome, phenomenal song that I randomly ran across on a YouTube video some years back, and that's how I heard about it. And I watched that several times. And then I, for some reason, I went online about it. I think what happened was somehow I went to YouTube, and I don't know why, and then you know, someone was talking about the meaning of the song, and I ended up on I typed into Google and I ended up on songmeanings.com. I think what it is, I might have been looking for lyrics and then I got this site instead. Songmeanings.com. Well, people will try and interpret a song, right? Every song, you know. And then people vote up and down on them. And then, so the best interpretations rise to the top. And so there I am, I'm reading about clocks, right? And of course, you know, people have all these theories. And he was in a dark time and, you know, relationship breakup and, you know, going on and on. And kind of generally a down tone. Well, this song is very inspirational and very up. And I think what was sort of interesting was that, you know, the song meanings was really the lyric meanings. That's how people were approaching the interpretation of this performance, was from the lyrics. You can start writing a song. Like, I know this from my documents, right? I start writing a toxic document thinking, you know, it's going to be fluoride, fluoride, fluoride. And it turns out it's a spectrum. And it turns out that caffeine is quite bad. And it turns out that paracetamol, acetaminophen is quite bad. And it's a spectrum. And salt is bang on, like exactly what they recommend. And the glass of wine a day is wrong. And you get all this sort of insightful stuff, right? So I know that you start off with one thought in your article, one thought in your analysis, and it can change. Well, it's got to be the same in creating a song. And I'm sure that with Coldplay, when they were creating the song, the guy who was sitting down with the lyrics, he might have been in a dark time. He might have been trying to draw from that, thinking, hey, let's put some meaning into this. But the performance, the music, is very different from that. The opposite. Well, anyway, at the end of this song, in this documentary/concert, it goes back to the, you know, documentary mode. And they're showing random stuff on the screen, doesn't matter. And one guy, probably the sort of the head spokesman type guy in the band, he starts talking and he says, right at the high point of this performance, the crowd's going berserk and it's just such a great song. And he goes, we have an unbelievable job. We have an unbelievable crew. We have unbelievable families. And we have really unbelievable fans. And so our job as a band is to try to become unbelievably good. And we're trying our best. And then he went on talking some really good stuff, really worth listening to. I just wanted to share that vignette, that little portion of the experience of this band performing. And man, they knocked it out of the park. This is the best live to DVD I've watched. Well, it's probably tied with Pink Floyd playing Dark Side of the Moon, that performance in Australia, where they perfectly play Dark Side of the Moon. That was pretty awesome. But this was slightly better because it was a little bit more about the people. And this band is a little bit more together. They've got it figured out what they're trying to do, and they're very humble, they're very determined, and just trying to do their very best. How awesome. These guys are just full of energy and life and fun, and they're irrepressible and just great. So that was my re-listen of the week, and what a treat. Just before I move on to the next section, one other thought I had in my notes. On song meanings, one of the people said that Clocks is up there with Time in a Bottle by Jim Croce and Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd as songs that use very few words to say so much. Again, you know, them sort of focusing on with the words versus the song. The way I grew up and what I listen to and what's my quality, that three-ish quality, three is much more about the music rather than the words. My dad was listening to rock when I started listening to music, so I grew up with that. And I grew up with rock songs. Rock songs have terrible lyrics on average, and you can hardly understand them, and they repeat, and they're boring, and everything else, and they're dumb and gross, and you name it. But it's the music that's progressive and interesting. Well, anyway, I think they sort of missed the boat on this one, but still, that's pretty high praise, right? Time in a Bottle and Wish You Were Here. I mean, Wish You Were Here is just a phenomenal, powerful song. Just so simple, played on an acoustic guitar. Wow. Oof. All right, I'm going to finish up with my rewatch of the week. I watched a documentary called A Life Ascending, 2010 documentary about a family, a guy and a family that are in British Columbia, where I was born, where I grew up, where I work. I don't know if I got the guy's name. I want to say like Berlinger or something like that. Swiss guy. Grew up in Switzerland. His dad, you know, they used to climb in the mountains type thing. They live in a valley. And he moved to British Columbia. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to quickly read the comment that I left for this documentary. And normally on IMDb you also vote.
and I usually vote. So in this one I say, I've not voted for this movie because I might be biased. I worked in the Rogers Pass where this guy did his guiding. He helps people climb mountains, and then they typically ski down them. So I say, I've worked in the Rogers Pass exactly where this guy guided. I drove through and shopped in Revelstoke, where this guy, that was his hometown. And I was born in, grew up in British Columbia. This is a story of an alpiner, Swiss-born, transplanted to the wonderful snow and mountains of British Columbia. A guide with an engineer's level of thoroughness. And snow, lots and lots of snow. Railways try for the lowest route through mountains. Still, the Rogers Pass CP Rail Camp got 10 feet of snow a year. I was a chief shoveler, otherwise known as a signal maintainer's helper. But I liked shoveling. It kept me warm when it was 40 below. Where this family live and guide, they seem to get two or three times as much snow. This documentary is worth a watch, even if you don't love mountains or snow. The credits have rolled. It was a good song during the end credits. Just kind of note, perfect song. I returned to my warmer world, changed a bit, and I sign off. So a life is ending. Kind of good. There's a tragedy in this story, because he's a guide, and they're hiking up in snow, right? And when you have a lot of snow, well, you can have avalanches, right? Don't want to spoil the story, but there is an avalanche in the story. It gets sort of mentioned, you know, indirectly and hinted at, and then it sort of builds to that moment, and then there's that moment, and then life carries on for some, right? You know, but just a well-done documentary, an interesting documentary. All right, looking at my quote of the week, and I finish up. This has run so long, I'm going to choose the shortest quote. It's a natural. You know how you see those signs? Slow, children playing. Some of them are shaped like a little weird creature out of yellow, a little red hat. And he's like holding out a sort of a symbolic little slow caution sign. Slow children playing, right? Well, you could come up with a variation of that. The sign could say, fast children playing. Because, you know, children are fast, right? They race around. They're like when you have a dog outside on the loose and suddenly the dog runs into traffic, right? Suddenly the kid runs into traffic. But it might be a little fun variation that someone could come up with. Maybe what you would say is slow in big letters, and then underneath you would have fast in, you know, a smaller, sort of a stylized different color font to point out fast children playing. Maybe underline the word fast so that slow because of fast. You know, we got an issue in this area where people drive fast and we got a stop sign out front and people run the stop sign routinely. It's sort of an entertainment for us because it's right outside of our kitchen window. And if you happen to be there and a car comes along, you always watch the car. Now it's just a habit. There's so many variations on how people go through it, blow through it. When people turn right these days, they basically don't stop. They just slow down, even though it's a stop sign. Kind of weird, you know. Just sort of evolves like that over time. And the crazy thing is that there are a total of 5 kids near that stop sign, like immediately adjacent to that stop sign. And then there are even other kids down our block who come up and play with the kids next to that stop sign. So there's even more kids, you know. That's it. Quote of the week done. Floydcast done. So this has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing the Floydcast, number 24 for July 28th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.